Hey everybody, this is Vitalik. Today is a very special episode. I have a super awesome guest, Joe Natoli. He is a really, really awesome UXer with tons of experience, tons of clients, tons of projects that he's worked for with. And got a great following on Twitter. I follow him. Other people that I admire follow him as well. Joe posts a lot of great content. He also has his podcast. I'll include all those links about him in the podcast notes. And Joe, welcome to the podcast. It's an honor.
Thank you very much. It is my honor to be here.
Is there anything for, you know, one or two people who listen to the podcast who don't know who you are? Do you want to tell a couple of words about yourself?
Sure. For the last almost, it's like 27 years at this point, I'm a user experience consultant, okay? And I work almost exclusively at this point for the last 7 or 8 years in particular with large global enterprise type organizations. And my job is to go in there and sit down with the teams and get real with them about, you know, there's always a UX defect or a UX problem with a product or a service or something that's outward facing. But the problem is usually deeper than that. Okay. If I always say that if UX defects wind up in a product, very rarely is it the case that it's because the people there that work there don't have the skill or the talent or the knowledge or any number of, you know, other performance related attributes. It's usually some dysfunction, right? In the way that the team works together and the way that the team works with management and the way that projects run in the organization itself. Okay. It's people, it's process, it's politics. It's my job that just to help them be better. And it's also, the older I get, this becomes more important to me. It's also my job to help them just live more pleasant lives, right? Less stress, less aggravation, less frustration. That's really important. You cannot do anything well if you're carrying around a 600 pound weight on your shoulders all the time. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do now, but I started out a million years ago in graphic design. I've been a serial entrepreneur all my life. I've started a couple magazines, a small record label, struck out on my own twice, sold my first company to an IT firm, which turned out to not be a very good thing. But you learn. Yeah. I ran my own company for about 10 years. And then I sold it to an IT firm in 2000. I'm going to get this wrong. I always screw it up. It's either 2004 or 2007. Hung out a couple of years to help them establish a UX practice, right, within the organization. Mm-hmm. Turns out that they really had no interest in that. very sort of toxic environment. A lot of people with a command and control mentality. And by that point, I'd been doing my own thing long enough that I just had no tolerance for that. You know, the only thing I've ever cared about in my life in terms of work is results, right? Mm-hmm. Are you getting results or are you not? Are you making money or are you making excuses? You know, and I don't have any patience for anything else. So at this point at 50 years old, I'm kind of I wouldn't be a very good employee for anybody. So I think the independent route is me for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I actually had a question for you. Why did you choose to become a consultant and not like, you know, traditional career path where you could be like a director, MVP, and then kind of, you know, Steve Jobs type of position?
Yeah.
But that story with entrepreneurship kind of explains it.
It kind of, and I tell people this all the time where they feel like they're stuck in their careers, right? UXers and designers in particular. Don't be in a rush to figure it out. Okay. To say, this is exactly what I want to be. This is exactly what I want to do. Or, you know, be upset with yourself that you don't know. Mm-hmm. I sort of slid into consulting in that I found that the times where my value seemed to be highest to people right? When we were able to achieve really good things, or when I had people's attention in the room, or when they came back to me afterwards and said, you know, that was really, really extremely helpful. And also, quite frankly, when I felt the most alive, when I felt like in what they call flow state, or this is what I'm supposed to be doing, I noticed that those were the times when I was in the room sort of talking and problem solving and helping people work through things as opposed to doing the tactical work, right? And the more I did that, the more people wanted me to do that and the more I enjoyed it. So it just grew from there. So that's kind of how I wound up doing consulting as opposed to, you know, the tactical work of design and UX.
I can absolutely relate to that. I started as a consultant and then I worked corporate jobs, but I was mostly in consulting type of roles, whether mm-hmm. it was a contract or full time. But I always tried to find a position where I would be a consultant. And it's not like I don't like, you know, doing all the job, but I enjoy a lot more really driving the change, driving the mindset, and educating people on how to do certain things better. Mm-hmm. And those are the roles that I've been most successful and enjoyed the most. And that's where I'm trying to be right now as I'm looking for my next gig at the moment. I'm working with
somebody. I think on one hand, designers, UXers, developers as well. I mean, if you think about where our core talent lies, right, and what we're best at, it really is when we're using what's between our ears. So to me, for a lot of people who do this work, consulting is a very natural fit because your greatest strength mm-hmm. Is how you think, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's a lot easier and more enjoyable for me to look at the process or look at a product and say, you know, it will work better if you do XYZ, and it will work better because of A, B, and B, and C. Mm-hmm. So that's, we are on the same page here. So I understand your consulting experience spans now at least 25 years, if not mm-hmm. more. Mm-hmm. How do you choose your clients? So what types of organizations in terms of size and industry do you target, or do you basically kind of whoever reaches out to you, you use certain criteria to see if you would like to spend your time consulting with mm-hmm. this client? What are your preferences?
Well, like I said, for the most part, this is at this point, it's almost exclusively really large organizations that have multiple locations, you know, sometimes in the States, sometimes globally. Mm-hmm. And that's really simply because over the years, I just found that I enjoy this is maybe it's some people might consider this like self-torture, maybe, but I enjoy big organizations because the problems that exist are equally big and equally complex and distributed and spread apart. And it's like, man, this is a challenge. I sort of like it when the task is big, you know, when it's challenging, when it forces me to stretch. Now, that's not to say I haven't worked for smaller mid-sized organizations. I have. I've worked for a couple startups here and there. If I think the main criteria for me is that I have to get the sense up front when we're talking as prospects, I have to get the sense up front that they are really committed to solving a problem, that they're really committed to being better, that they're really committed to delivering value, to people. And they're not just giving me lip service, because ostensibly what happens is, And I'm lucky in that companies approach me at this point. I don't do any marketing anymore mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, going out and trying sure. to find clients. I'm lucky, ungodly lucky. But I was going somewhere with that. I forgot where it was. I know what it was. I mean, essentially they come to you and they say, well, we need to redesign this, right? Or we need to update this. Or sometimes it's, you know, we've got a problem in this particular area. In other words, they sort of come to you with a solution. We think this needs to happen. My first order of business is to ignore whatever it is that they're asking me or whatever it is that they're suggesting, not in a rude way, in a polite way, and saying, okay, tell me what's behind that. So even the first prospect conversation, even the first conversation with a prospect is consulting to me, right? Tell me why you feel that's necessary. Tell me why you think this is what needs to happen. And then they start telling me about, you know, issues that they have. Mm-hmm. And the longer that conversation goes on, I get a sense for, okay, are they willing to go down the path and find out what the real causes of these symptoms are? Or are they just convinced that, no, we want to check these boxes and move on? If it's we want to check these boxes and move on, then I politely decline. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just like when I say, here's how we start the engagement. Okay. Day one, we get representatives from all your departments, anyone that's even remotely connected to this, and we have a big conversation. If there's any resistance to that, it's probably not a good fit. Okay. So I back out of those things. But I am always excited to solve problems, you know, to dig into difficult circumstances and see what's going on. I love that.
Awesome.
I hope I answered your question.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I wish I was, you know, that lucky. And I mean, I'll work hard to be as lucky as you are when big clients come and knock on my door, and I get to choose. It's a great place to be.
It'll come. It'll come, and it'll come from, I'm going to be absolutely honest with you. It's hard to realize this early in your career because I certainly didn't. Okay, but I got this advice over and over and over again from older, more experienced people. And I didn't take it, of course. But what people kept telling me was, you've got to position yourself as, no, I'm really only interested in helping you solve the real problem. Okay. I don't want to be the guy who just checks the boxes. Now that means that you lose work, right? Because some people aren't going to be willing to go with you. But the longer you do that, the longer you become the person who says, okay, I know you're saying you want this, but I think it's worth looking at A, B, C, D, E as well. As long as you continue to be that guy, you will find yourself, you know, or girl, woman, man, whatever, you will find yourself eventually, I think, where I am, you know, provided you're good at what you do. I really think that's what it is. You have to sort of insist that there's more to the picture that meets the eye, because that's where the value is. And once you help somebody, an organization in particular, solve a really difficult problem that makes a massive difference in their bottom line, they look at you very, very differently.
This is exactly right. And I have two small comments. So comment number one, I can relate to the turning down work. When I set up my account on Fiverr, I'm sure you know about this website, right?
Yeah.
Yep. In 2015, I read about that on Business Insider, and I figured, you know, maybe it's something that I could do just to see how it goes and maybe learn something. And in the beginning, I just kind of took whatever came my way, you know, I specialize in financial models back then because I worked for Ameriprise Financial, and I was really, really good in building all kinds of financial and number models, like, you know, literally software programs like SAS could be developed from my models. But, and I figured maybe it's something that I could do on Fiverr. But then very soon I started getting offers from people who didn't even know what they were doing. And by just looking at the business model of what they were trying to do and sketching a really quick kind of back of the napkin financial model, I would say it's not going to work because X, Y, Z. And they said, you know, we are the founders. We probably know more than you. We just need the financial model from you. And I said, you know, guys, if
do it yourself.
Yeah, and they offered good money, but I said, you know, I just like at the, you know, biological level, I cannot do something that I know is going to fail. And even if I'm wrong, I don't know that I'm wrong. I think I am right. So maybe in the future I will get some proof that I was wrong. But at this moment of making the decision, I truly believe that the business model is not sustainable. The financial model doesn't make any sense because I sketched it up and I turned down a lot of those offers. And the second comment is relates to, I don't know if you listen to Tim Ferriss podcast, Seth Godin, you know, a pretty famous marketer, was on his podcast a couple of months ago. Yeah. And he actually, in this podcast episode, he mentioned, he exactly used the Fiverr example that, you know, if you do Fiverr, you will just, you know, work hourly and you will probably not land a lot of good clients. But what's really important is to get good clients. And that means turning down a lot of work that is not as fulfilling, because when you really get good clients, they give you more interesting work, they challenge you more. You get a more fulfilling experience from working with those clients and things like that, right? So, and I think that's exactly right.
Yep, that's the way it goes. I mean, there's, like I told you, okay, I got that advice plenty of times very early on in my career, especially when I'd started my own company, you know, just like, you know, fire bad clients. You know, people who question invoices. I had a client once who used to question every invoice I sent her, all right? And they were, this was a flat fee project. There were four increments of this much. The contract specified those dollar amounts. There was no part of this that was a surprise. Wow. I swear to you, every single invoice, and this went on for a year, how dumb I was. I would get them back and things would be circled. You know, we still had fax in those days. I would get them back and things would be circled. Why is this so much money? Are you serious? And finally, I just had enough. And that was really a defining moment for me, because when I fired her, I never did that again. Okay. The first time I got a hint that kind of stuff was going to happen, I was out the door. Like, you need to find somebody who's an order taker, because it's not what I do, you know? So you're absolutely correct in that approach. It's not always easy, especially, you know, when you're early on and you got bills to pay and things get stressful. Okay. I've been down to the bottom more than once in all the time I've been doing this. All right. But eventually that evens out. But the only way it evens out, the only way you get good work, the only way you get good clients is by being really judicious about what you accept. It really does matter. You got to get good outcomes for people, because if you don't, those clients are never going to sing your praises. They're not going to tell anybody else. And word of mouth in almost any industry, but in ours in particular, carries tremendous weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you want people to sing your praises and recommend you and say, I have somebody you should talk to.
So to piggyback on how you come into organizations and, you know, start understanding what problem are they trying to solve, and you're probably also trying to get an understanding what authority you will have in this particular consulting project. And I think it's important because I tweeted a few times when I said that, or maybe I was just engaged with somebody in a conversation, but in a few projects, especially if it was not really a consulting, but more of a kind of, you know, full-time job contract where you would come in and start helping and become like a full team member, not as a consultant per se, I always try to set some ground rules, if you will, in terms of like what kind of executive decisions will I be allowed to make. For example, if somebody tells me that we need this screen to look like this, or we need this functionality on the screen, and I believe it makes absolutely no sense, Sometimes I want to be able to override those decisions. And if I set some ground rules coming into the project that can, you know, give me the platform to have more chances to succeed versus if you come into the project and people just keep telling you what to do and you just do what they say, although 100% of that can be wrong. How do you negotiate this soft piece with your clients? I know that, you know, some hard pieces can be written in the contract, you know, I do this, they do that. But in terms of authority and decision-making on certain features of the product or, you know, logic, dynamics within the product, how do you approach that?
Well, to be honest with you, I've never stipulated that. I've never had to, as far as my consulting career goes. And I think the reason, is this, with what you're saying, I completely, agree. You have to be able to say, look, I think this is a bad idea and here's why it's a bad idea. But I believe that there are always egos at play in any kind of organization. Okay. And I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way. A lot of what people consider to be ego, right, from executives to product managers to team members to whoever, is usually the result of fear, all right? And it's fear of making the wrong decision. It's fear of not understanding what's going on here. It's fear that, you know, this could really hurt us if we get it wrong, any number of things. So what I normally do is, I mean, when I talk to prospects up front, I mean, I tell them, I do take great pains to say, you know, this is going to be a collaborative effort, all right? Which means I am going to involve you in everything that I'm doing. I'm going to want to talk to people from these areas as we dig through this. But understand, I am not an order taker by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. If we're going to work together towards an end goal, I am absolutely down, right? I will be your best and fiercest ally. That's how I roll. But I've never had to insist for, you know, to have control over any of those decisions, because what I say at every outset, because sometimes they ask, they say, well, what if, you know, we disagree about something? What if we propose something you don't agree with, or you propose something that we don't agree with? And my answer to that is always, look, at the end of the day, it's your money and it's your organization. Okay. So by right, that is your decision to make, but I am absolutely going to be 1000% honest with you. If I think that you're doing something that is risky, that could hurt you, that could hurt your customers and in turn hurt you, or any number of things, you're going to hear that from me and I'm going to do my best to explain why. All right. And the benefit of experience, I always say this as well, the benefit of doing anything as long as I have is not that you're suddenly the smartest person in the room, because I am not by any stretch. Mm-hmm. What I do have is a lot of time over the target. And what that's like, the longer you go on, is that you feel like you're seeing the same movies over and over and over and over again, right? And to the tune of, you know what happens next.
Like, you know, you can, Groundhog Day.
Yeah, you can predict the plot. You can predict what's going to take place. You can sometimes even predict what people are going to say. It's a little scary, but it's the truth. Okay, so what I say is, in a lot of cases, I've seen this movie before. I know how it ends, and if you want to go down that path, you're going to have to do it without me. Okay, I can't, in good conscience, help you do that, because I think you're going to be very unhappy with the result. And after that, right, it really is their decision. The reason I approach it that way is because of the fear that I mentioned. I think the minute you start jockeying for position or control, or, you know, I really want control over this part of what I'm doing, the minute you do that in a formal way, you become an adversary, whether you mean to or not. All right. To some degree, that's intimidating to people. It's threatening. It makes them nervous, because you're a black box to executives in particular, to even to product owners, project managers, and sometimes even to people working on the project. If you're sort of the UX person in the room, you know, you're a black box. Okay. They don't really firmly understand what it is that you do. They don't really firmly have a grasp on how you're going to help them or what you're going to advocate for. Mm-hmm. All they know is that they're screwing up somewhere or they're having pain or they're having discomfort, and they need some help. But it makes them very nervous to hand over control of any kind to something that they're really not that familiar with.
Right.
So I think it's a balancing act.
Well, this is a.
But I do not. I want to clarify. I want to make sure that I say this. I do not believe you should ever take on a consulting gig or even any gig, right? Any position in any organization at UX design development, where you're an order taker. There's no value in that.
Mm-hmm. And this is a great answer. Gives a lot of good insight. And to be clear, when I said that, you know, I'm trying to every time I take on a project, I'm trying to negotiate certain things. It never means that I formally put something in the contract, right? I just ask questions.
Yeah. No, I got you.
If I come into the project, what authority over decision making can I expect?
It's a great question to ask.
Will there be one person who will always override my decisions? Or I will have some kind of my word will have some kind of weight. So yeah, and obviously it's pretty impossible to even formulate that into a document. Like, you know, Vitalik will be able to control every single pixel on the screen, and nobody will be able to do that. So, but I because asking this question actually helps me. Get a feel of, because the way they answer, the way they, you know, you see their body language when they answer this question, does that make them comfortable or not? It just gives you a lot of understanding about that particular person who you will work with or how the, or the culture. Because, you know, the answers have been on both sides of the spectrum, like, you know, from, you know, you're just a consultant. So we're going to take what we want from you, and then we're going to make all of our own decisions to the other spectrum where, you know, we are hiring you for a reason, and we will closely consider every single recommendation. So, but yeah, I mean, this question and this quick conversation just tells me a lot about what to expect. And then when I go back home and I just, you know, weigh all those learnings and say, do I really want to spend the next few months working in this culture or I just...
In this situation,
So,
no, it's absolutely, you're absolutely correct. For example, and I suggest that people get in the habit of asking this question, right? When you're sort of evaluating a company, who has the power to shut this down? Okay. Who in the organization can swoop in and say, you know what? We're not doing this anymore. Because that person had better be involved at least at the outset. Okay. You need to have at least one conversation with that human being to understand where they're coming from. Because otherwise, the minute they don't like what's going on, the minute they get afraid, the minute they get nervous, right? They're coming in and you know, probably going to do some damage. So everything you're saying is absolutely correct. You've got to know those things before you get into something, before you commit to spending, you know, your time and effort.
I never asked this question. I never thought about this question, but it's so good that I'm just going to, you know, put it in my arsenal. And I'm going to ask it every single time. Because I mean,
oh, it's a good one.
Yeah. It also gives you a high level view of the work structure, which is pretty important. Because if, you know, the person who is able to shut that down is a person in marketing, which, you know, another probably enough content for another episode to discuss. That will tell you a lot. Like, you know, why is marketing driving this product? It doesn't make any sense.
Oh yeah. I stopped a meeting once actually, because they were telling me about what they had done, you know, right prior to my coming in, this last big initiative. And I kept hearing, okay, that there are three people in particular through product marketing who were driving this bus. And I sort of called a timeout and I said, it sounds to me like up until now, for the last 3 years, at least based on what you're telling me, marketing has run this show. They're like, yeah, that's accurate. I said, well, where are they? We need those people in this room now before we talk about anything else. Okay. They need to be looped into this conversation. Now, why nobody thought of that, I don't really know. Could be that they were, you know, they're trying to do an end around. Like, let's work around marketing and see if we could sneak something in. But sure enough, we brought those people in and they had very little idea what was going on.
What?
All right. And we spent the next 4 hours smoothing that out and making and trying to get everybody on the same page, which thankfully it worked out because everybody wanted the same thing. So I played therapist, you know, for a couple hours and, well, and got everybody to talk.
Being a therapist.
It's part of the job description. It really is.
Right. Like a bullet point, you know, therapeutical services, right? On the invoice as, yeah, as a line item.
I was in Mexico and at a conference, and Stephen Gates of Envision spoke there as well. And he said, and we talked about this afterwards, he said that, you know, a lot of what he does is, I think he called it, if I remember correctly, executive hysteria management. Mm-hmm. and it's in some cases, it's more like, you know, personnel hysteria management in a lot of ways, because that's not giving anybody a hard time. That's a lot of times people are not talking to each other and they don't realize the degree to which they're not talking to each other. And the stress as a result is unbelievably high, mm-hmm. You know? So sometimes the first thing you have to do is get people to communicate with each other again.
So marketing is one of the things that I would like to talk to a little bit more in this particular, because mm-hmm. I actually touched on this in the very first episode with Oksana, and we mm-hmm. kind of ranted about that for, you know, 5 or so minutes. But I personally experienced battles with marketing in some of my projects. And I personally believe in very clear role descriptions, and certain things cannot be influenced or at least influenced by much by other organizations in terms of product development. So in this mm-hmm. very example, for example, or you can use another example if it's more appropriate, why was marketing driving the bus? And after you had this therapeutic session, what was the outcome, and were they still driving the bus after this therapeutic mm-hmm. session?
Well, the reason in that instance, and the reason this happens in a lot of organizations, has a lot to do with history. Okay. In that there was a time in this company's history, in a lot of companies' histories, that this thing called the internet didn't exist. Mm-hmm. Okay. So a lot of organizations delivered their products and services through traditional channels, and their outward face to the world to present that stuff was marketing. Okay. So let's accept that as a premise.
Yeah.
So then the internet comes along and changes the game radically for everybody. And over a period of time, you know, maybe in the next 10, 15 years, these companies find that they are suddenly in the software business, all right, in the web software business to some degree, because the delivery method for all their products and services are now digital, right? They're online, they're it's apps, it's sites, it's systems. Mm-hmm. This is unfamiliar territory. Okay, so the senior leadership at almost every level, from executives to mid-level management, this is new territory for them. It's unfamiliar, and they are so busy with their heads down just trying to do their jobs that they don't have time to sort of relearn everything that is now involved in, okay, we have to be experts at software now. So what happens? Marketing has been driving that bus, so they're still driving that bus. Now, the second part is they know they need technology help, but they don't necessarily see the connections between technology, which is traditionally IT, okay, and product marketing and customer experience and what we now call user experience and design. So what happens? They have an IT department because, okay, we need information technology now, right? Because we have to adapt. Mm-hmm. Well, IT is IT focused. IT isn't UX focused. IT in historically, okay, isn't design focused. So now what happens is you've still got marketing in a position of we're the outward facing communication with the rest of, you know, humanity. And then IT is driving the technology bus because they're responsible for that. In that rush to like, we got to get a handle on this. Now you've got sort of two departments operating on separate tracks. A lot of these companies have tried to bridge that gap with a greater understanding of design or design thinking or UX or any of those things. But it's tough going. If the entire culture of an organization that's been around for 40, 50 years or more is predicated on a certain model, it is very difficult to undo all that infrastructure at the very least, right? Not to mention people's sort of long-held beliefs. And pivot, it's hard. It takes time. It takes a lot of time. All right. So like in the situation that I described to you, that's one of those situations. Everybody is sort of trying to find their feet. Mm-hmm. And the truth is they all have experience and acumen and skills and insight to lend, but they have never been sort of asked to work together to do that. Right? Because the gray area is between their two disciplines. Do you get what I'm saying?
This is absolutely awesome. So, keep going.
So what we did is I said, look, you've got, and that's what was happening in this company. There were parallel tracks. IT was doing its thing. Marketing was doing its thing. And this group of folks responsible for product development, right? More on the strategy side. We're saying we don't know how we wound up here. All right. And how they wound up here is because this gray area between marketing and technology was never properly addressed. All right. So whether or not you're going to hire a bunch of UI designers and UX people and information architects and developers and whoever, the first order of business is we got to get the big players together and get them to realize that they both want the same thing. All right, and get them to realize that they have something to contribute here. And what they needed me for in that instance was to help direct that traffic, to help them understand those intersections, to help them see where they should be working together, where they should be communicating with each other, where they should be relying on each other's expertise, right? The analogy that I gave them and the analogy I give a lot of organizations is this. I grew up learning how to do lots of things from fixing cars to building houses. Okay. In every conceivable aspect, I had contractors in my family. My father was a process engineer, excellent mechanic, excellent carpenter. So I learned how to do all sorts of things. Anytime you're building something, all right, or fixing something, it is to your benefit to work with another person. Why? So that when you say, okay, I think what's going on here is this. I think the reason this isn't working is A, B, and C. And you're able to look at that other person and say, what do you think of that? Does that sound right? Does that sound accurate? You think we should try this? And that person says, yeah, I think that makes sense based on what we've seen. Or they say, yeah, but you might want to try this first. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you got somebody to check yourself against. And the sum total is, you know, it's like measure twice, cut once kind of analogy, which everybody always makes. But it's a better way to go about doing anything. This is no different. All right. So once we sort of made that argument, once we spent the remaining portion of that day having conversations, putting all their stuff on the table, and which included some distrust, right? Like or misunderstandings. Like, well, those guys never listened to us. Well, you never asked us. You never told us that that's what you wanted. Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Okay, once you get past all that, human beings, more often than not, once you remove the fear and misunderstanding in the room, are willing to work with each other. All right. So that's what we did there. And after that point, because I still work with this company, mm-hmm. On a recurring basis, what happened after that point is that neither department is driving that bus anymore. They're collaborating. They're working together, you know, on a daily basis. They do have some designers on staff. Now they've got, you know, a UX person on staff, but from marketing to design to development to even, you know, IT and security, database guys, everybody is communicating and they're understanding that how all this stuff overlaps, and they're checking each other constantly, and it's working much better. Is it friction free? No, but it's infinitely better than where it was. And the company is in better shape as a result, and customers are much happier as a result. So that's probably a long-winded way of answering your question, but I hope I hit at least something.
Oh, no, that was absolutely awesome. And it makes perfect sense. That's exactly what I, you know, thought would be the right answer, especially with your experience to back it up. In terms of...
Even young companies, if I want to say one more thing, I'm sorry. Even because I want everybody to realize this, young people in particular, okay, even young organizations, even new businesses, even companies that have only been around for 5 years, you have to understand that what you learn in business school, most entrepreneurs, what they learn about being in business and doing business is still very traditional. Yes, we're in an enlightened age where we talk about user experience and customer experience and design and this kind of thing all the time. But by and large, business programs, business publications, the media, websites, podcasts do not talk about this stuff to the degree that they right. should. So as far along as you think we may be with the understanding of UX, business is still by and large very, as a culture, is kind of still a little bit behind. It's not talked about, not taught to the degree that it should be. Just like UXers and designers aren't taught business to the degree that they should be. Okay. I firmly believe that that problem goes both ways.
And this is a good addition. Absolutely. So to piggyback on, you know, driving the bus and kind of transition a little bit to product ownership. I used to do a lot of work in terms of process reengineering. One of the mm-hmm. largest scale projects that I had is to help create a process through the entire organization, Ameriprise Financial, where we mapped a global process of acquiring a company. They made a very hasty acquisition of a small advisor firm, you know, down in Florida somewhere, and they did mm-hmm. some things right. They did some things wrong, and then they basically hired our internal consulting group to help them engineer the process next time they would go to acquire another company to know what steps to take and how to go about that. And the reason I bring that up is because designing a process absolutely has to have ownership of every single step, or you know, you break. In our case, it was a really huge process. There was one kind of overall owner responsible for that process, somebody from the acquisition team. But then, as you broke it in stages, like for example, you know, sales and then IT and then financial advisor groups and whatnot, parts of the process were owned by certain people, and we actually had to. It was mm-hmm. a pretty stressful time to identify those people.
I bet.
And conducted all those interviews with people who were involved in the process, you kind of get a good idea of who can potentially own certain parts of the process. And then you actually had to sell them the idea of them being the owner next time an acquisition happens, because, you know, they just seem right for the job. And it's not like it's a full-time job, right? It's a one-off basis, but
right,
they were so reluctant because they... they still have the memory of this disruption that this first acquisition brought into their lives, how they, you know, burnt midnight oil, and they really don't, humans do not want any additional responsibilities and accountabilities that they usually have. So this kind of a,
well, yeah, because they're overworked already.
And it's
yeah.
just human nature, you know, just leave me alone and let me do my job, right? So yeah. with this kind of background, going back into the product ownership, I always believe that, you know, every single process, every single product has to be owned end to end by somebody. It cannot be owned by a group of people. Although, you know, teamwork sounds great, one single person has to be, in my opinion, I could be wrong, responsible for either the product or, you know, something like that. What do you see in organizations these days in terms of product ownership? And I know that product owner role recently appeared on the job market before it was, mm-hmm. you know, because I've been in this contract market for a couple of years now. Before it was just, you know, standard stuff like BA, PMs, UX designers, and information architects.
Yeah, right.
And depending on the scale of the project, you either get all of them or you get kind of a small version, you know, without information architects, for example, or process engineers, and then UX people kind of do that job. What do you see in terms of those type of org structures around product development, and what's the best ownership structure that you have seen that turned out to be most successful?
Well, I think I honestly believe I'm a huge fan of the product owner mm-hmm. role, and the clients that I have, the recurring clients that I have right now, are all very fortunate to have product owners who are excellent at what they do. I'm gonna spend a week with one of them next mm-hmm. week. 5 days with them and their team. The best, I think. So I agree with you. Somebody has to be in a position of saying, okay, we are absolutely going to collaborate and get everybody's opinions and insights and feedback. We're going to work together to figure out, you know, what we're doing, why we're doing it, what's worth doing, what's important, what's feasible. But at the end of the day, somebody has to say, okay, just like the general on the battlefield, right? Here's the battle plan. Here's what I think we should do.
Exactly.
That is important because otherwise, right, the team and everybody else, it's easy to get stuck. And sometimes here's the reality of doing this work, of doing software development or product development of any kind, is that you are never 100% certain, mm-hmm. okay? You don't ever 100% know that this is the right thing to do. It just doesn't exist, all right? So at some point, somebody has to say, all right, we're going to take this leap, we're going to take this amount of risk, and let's see what happens and play it forward. These folks that I'm talking about in the product owner role, these men and women who I'm speaking of that I have personal experience with, the reason they're excellent at what they do is because they have made it their job to understand all these different facets of product development, right? From executive and business concerns to marketing concerns to you know, user experience issues, customer experience issues, support issues, UI design, front-end development, mid-tier logic issues, back-end development. The list goes on and on and on. All right. They're not experts in every one area, but they are absolutely constantly working to make sure that all those things inform their decisions, right? So that they go forward, minimizing risk, and going down a path that at least in the short and long term is highly likely to produce value. All right. So I really believe in that role. I think it's the right title. I think it's the right positioning because they live between all these departments. Now it means a lot of stress for them, quite frankly, because it's a lot of juggling. It's a tremendous amount of juggling, right? If you do the job well. But like I said, these folks that I've been privileged to work with, especially for the last 5 years, are incredible at what they do. And they care a great deal about the outcome for everyone involved. So I really believe in that role, and I'd like to see it continue. I'd like to see it expand.
Mm-hmm. This is awesome. So in your opinion, is product owner and product manager are the same?
They tend to be, in my experience, the same. I've seen it called both. The difference I see is when someone is called a project manager, because that is usually somebody who's responsible for logistics, right? It's time, it's budget, it's effort, mm-hmm. it's schedule, mm-hmm. it's making sure that the trains run on time. That can be a product owner, but I think those are two very big jobs right. in and of themselves. All right. I really firmly believe that every project should have a project manager or managers whose job it is just to help everybody keep the train on the tracks. You know, I don't think it's possible to do that job plus a product ownership job mm-hmm. equally well. Okay. Just like, and I probably shouldn't go here. I was about to say it and I thought maybe I shouldn't say it. Just like I'm going to say it anyway. I don't believe that it's possible to do UX or UI design and development of any kind equally well. Something is going to suffer.
Absolutely.
All right. You don't have the, if for no other reason than you do not ever have the time necessary to do both jobs equally well. So I think that the project management and project ownership thing is the same issue. I think you want people in product ownership roles who their sole job, okay, is like I said, to bring all that stuff together and make sure that the team as a whole and the company as a whole is making informed, smart decisions.
So the reason I ask this question is because that's something that I feel very passionately about, and it mm-hmm. was a way to have an expert and professional like you to actually validate my assumptions, and you fully validated them.
That's been my experience.
Yeah, right. So I really struggled in the last few years with my identity in terms of my role in the product development organizations. And as the market has been kind of fragmented before in terms of like there are BAs, there are project managers, there are UX designers, developers, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I've always been, and you know, there are change managers too, right? People who come in to yeah. change yep. Certain behaviors in certain organizations. And I've always been like, I like a lot of from the BA work, and I did a lot of that. I like mm-hmm. driving projects, but I by no means want to be a project manager. I mean, I'm not a scheduler. I'm not a note taker. I mean, I can right. take my own notes in terms of, you know, what I think is important to me, but I would not absolutely be taking notes and, you know, distributing them through organizations. And then somebody would yell at me, how come you didn't, you know, write about that, right? So, and then I love a lot of stuff about the UX work because I am like, this is my biggest passion to design very elegant and very simple and very easy to use software products. And I also have a background in management consulting where we did a lot of change management, and that was actually globally. When you, for example, fly to Kuwait and you are trying to change the mindset and behavior of people who have been doing something for, you know, 30 years, and then some consultant from the yeah. U.S. Flies in and says, well, you know, you've been doing it all wrong, right? So you kind of learn how to do those things more politically correct and stuff like that. So, and I've been really struggling, and like in terms of tuning my resume to, like, if you apply to a BA, you need to kind of calibrate your resume to look more like a BA. If you apply as an information architect, you kind of, you know, tweak certain things
sure.
to pull some BA work over to look like more information architect stuff. And then when I saw product owner roles, whether the descriptions were perfect or not, it was like a, you know, fresh air to me. I'm like, this is exactly who I am. I love owning
that sounds like it.
Development end to end and drive the vision, drive the roadmap if necessary, and deliver and test and communicate with customers, and then basically, you know, drive the team of all those people, you know, BA, UX, developers, project managers, to make sure that my deliverable, I'm 100% accountable for this particular software product, and I will be I will be fully accountable for any problem, any user frustration that comes from this product, revenue loss that we experience because of the product, bad product design that I could potentially make, right? So this has been like a true revelation for me. I'm like, finally, you guys came up with this role, and I no longer have to tweak my resume, because I said, I'm a product owner, and that's it. And I told all my recruiters, and I mean, information architect role somehow is being stretched as a product owner too, so I'm not really excluding that. So.
No, but I love this.
I'm currently working with this. It's either product owner or information architect with product owner type of, you know, scope of description. And then I said, don't bother me with BAs or, you know, stuff like that. So, and what you said just fully validated what I have believed in and that I'm finally kind of getting at with this.
That is awesome. Absolutely awesome, because you, all right, and it's funny that we wound up here, because as you were talking, I got the sense that, like, okay, he's probably primed to be a product owner, okay? And the truth is this, UX people in particular, I think, are uniquely positioned to be product owners because of the holistic view of all these things. Now, do they all want to do that? Probably not. But I will also tell you that the product owners that I'm speaking of, okay, none of them have any formal UX background whatsoever. But to a person, okay, they all have been doing UX focused work their entire careers. They wouldn't call it that. Mm-hmm. But that's what it is. I can't tell you how many times I heard from this particular group of people, all of them, right, in some way said, well, you know, I don't really know a whole lot in the way of UX. And I laughed and I said, you know a hell of a lot more than you think, okay, because you're doing the work already. The things that you're surfacing, the questions that you're asking, the paths that you're encouraging your teams to go down have everything to do with the principles of positive user experience as it relates to, right, providing value to users and customers and thereby providing value back to the organization, the value loop I talk about all the time. They're doing UX work already. Whether they call it that or not, they're doing it. All right, so it's really good. It's really good. It's actually, I'm sitting here, it's making me very happy to hear you say this, because I think it's awesome. It's awesome. People who have a head or toward these things, again, I think are really well positioned to be excellent product owners. So good for you.
Well, yeah, thank you so much. I mean, this validation and especially the follow up after that validation is huge. It is huge. It was one of the goals for me to get that out of having a detailed conversation with you around those topics, and then basically, you know, arriving at this conclusion. Yeah, I mean, I've always been analytical in terms of, like, you know, I've always been calibrating, like, where I am at every single moment, what experience I have, what vision do I have for myself in the future, and it was confusing pretty often, because the world changes, the organizations change, positions change, job descriptions change, and then you just always trying to fit in. And then I kind of stopped for a second and I said, okay, let's focus on the passion. I love building beautiful software products, and nobody can tell me that I'm wrong about that. And so that was kind of like one huge point that I just drove into the ground. And then I'm like, okay, so how do I, you know, fit into an organization and actually, you know, get a job and get into a position to exercise my passion, right? And I started my career way back again as a consultant. That's why I still have this mindset. And it was strategy consulting, it was management consulting. I remember, I think it was 2007, we were sitting in Kuwait at the table with the billionaire guy who owned the company, and we've been telling him how to do his retail stores better. And then I kind of proceeded to business model consulting. So basically all levels of the organization, starting with the strategy and the business model, all the way.
Right.
Because
right.
It's such a huge ecosystem, I believe, that, like, you know, you can't really build a business model without understanding your product, because product drives the business
right.
model and the other way around. And then
that's right.
Once you understand what your business model is going to be and what your product is going to be, you actually need to execute the product architecture to reflect the business model. Because, you know, if, for example, you mm-hmm. try to monetize a product by doing XYZ, you actually need to develop certain features to help with the execution of this monetization. And if they are not executed properly, the customer will struggle. They will not help you monetize yep. those features that your entire business model depends on. So it's such a huge ecosystem. And the more people move towards the structure where there's one person who understands, I think the closest person who came to that was probably Steve Jobs. And I know he was not the best manager, you know, yelling at people and whatnot. But he just
had, yeah, there's nothing good about those parts.
Right. but he just had this laser vision for the product.
Well, and he understood the overlaps.
Yeah.
He understood the overlaps. That's what you're talking about.
To every single pixel on the screen. I mean, that huge span.
Right.
CEO, hundred millions of dollars right. a year in, you know, salary or stocks, and like a one small pixel on the screen. That's the span of his competencies and scope of authority and decision making.
Right.
So.
Right. So it, like, just like, okay, yourself, you're talking about a product ownership role. They understand the overlaps.
Yep.
Okay. It's their job to live in those spaces between, you know, between disciplines, between activity, between insight, between all these different things. And their job is to bring all that together again. So as I hear about, you know, your experience, you're living in those overlaps, right? And like I said before, when you do something, you know, and all of a sudden you sort of hit upon something that makes you feel like, wow, yeah, this is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, right? And it sounds right and it feels right, and your body temperature changes as a result. Mm-hmm. That's how you know, that's how in your career, that's how you know you're on the right track, you know? So I think all of this, It's really great to hear this, and I hope that people who are listening consider it as well, because this discipline in particular, the product ownership discipline, I think needs you. All right.
And I'll tell you a little more. So in terms of being a little bit confusing and maybe lacking some kind of focus, because of all those things that I believe that I'm really good at, those overlaps, right? You start thinking that, you know, you don't have a niche, because, you know, the world is moving to very narrow specializations. You have to be really, mm-hmm. in order to be more successful, you really need to be good, very, very good. Basically, you pick an area and you go deep. And my background was that I've been kind of more of a generalist, right? Like, when you tell people I'm good at this and this and this and that, they kind of lose focus. And they're like, they especially recruiters, right? Like, how do I sell you to clients? They need yeah. a VA, and you're telling me you can be a CEO and a UX designer, right? Like, how do I sell you to my clients? And so In my career, I applied to all kinds of positions and all kinds of companies that, overlapped with all those overlaps, right? I would apply to the Boston Consulting Group, and then they would not even invite me for an interview. I would apply to Deloitte, blockchain architecture or something position, because I have the, crypto and blockchain experience, and they would not return my calls. And then it also kind of has this effect of like, am I a loser? Am I just trying to blanket the entire earth and be everybody to everywhere, everything to everybody? And it's such a huge struggle. And then I'm like, okay, I'll narrow it down. I will not be applying to Boston Consulting anymore to be a strategy consultant, because, screw them. They're so arrogant. I will just focus on software development, and hopefully I will be able to sell my vision to recruiters or hiring managers. And then by getting into
You got to find the right spot.
I will be able to prove my value, because I will start in this niche. And as, project goes on and conversations happen, because in every single project that I come into, I always, take it all the way to the strategy and business model level, because it's natural. Yeah. You cannot talk about product design without questioning the product intent, the product strategy, and eventually the business model, and all the way.
Of course. And how can you how can you design properly if you don't understand any of that stuff?
Absolutely.
Amen. Amen. I've been a generalist all my life. All right. I resisted specialization from the get-go, and I was told over and over and over again that that was a bad idea. You have to specialize. And you know what? I just say, no, I don't agree with that. I mean, we talk about product owners, right? That is, you are a generalist. You have to be a generalist to some degree to do that job well, And I came up in a design program where it was hammered into us that designers, your job is not just a visual design. Your job is to know all this other stuff and be able to do all this other stuff. In that, if you were good at what you do, if you were truly worthy of the title, all right, and this is when it was just design, there was no UX or anything like that, then you should be able to work for any client in any industry in any type of application. Whatever the output may be, you should be excellent at it. All right. When it was print, it was everything from TV, radio, to brochures, to brand identity, to books, to magazines, to advertisements, whatever the case may be. You should be able to be excellent at all of it, no matter who it's for, what it's for, who the audience is. That's your job, okay? To interpret, to learn, to understand, and to communicate in context of that business, that audience. UI, UX, product ownership, development, it's all the same thing. There is no such thing as, well, I can only do this in this industry. I don't buy that. Okay. I've never bought it, and I'll go to my grave not buying it. All right. If you're good at what you do, those constraints are irrelevant. If you're good at what you do, you pay attention to the surroundings around you, you learn what you don't know, and you apply it. Right. So, no, I don't think you're wrong about any of this. It's not an easy road because the world likes things in neat little boxes with labels.
Exactly. That's how the world
this is for this exact. But see, to me, that need for narrow categorization and the need to put labels and everything and say, well, it's this or it's this, is a denial of just how messy and complicated life and work in general really is. Okay, it's messy. Let's just stop bullshitting each other that everything is so clear cut. It's not. Nothing in life is like that. All right. So this, I don't know. I mean, I'm on a in praise of generalists rant.
No,
here.
But this is
and it's your fault
because
you started.
Absolutely awesome, because this is another huge validation for me. As I said, I mean, this episode is a really selfish episode for me to get a lot of validation in terms of my beliefs from a professional like you.
Well, it's important because I don't think you're alone there. All right. Based on the mail that I get and the direct messages I get, I don't think you're alone
there. Well, and hopefully, yeah, I think this episode, just, you know, people who listen to that, they will actually, you know, become more self-confident and more guided in terms of what to do next.
I hope so.
And so your answer actually just reminded me of all those job descriptions that I see and kind of feel not intimidated by, but kind of like frustrated. You know, a good example, hiring a UX designer or a product owner for, and in the required qualifications, like a requirement, not like a desired, you have to have SaaS experience. And to your point, you know, it's probably better for you if I don't have any SaaS experience, because I will
That's
come
right.
with a fresh set of eyes, not a person who designed those, you know, services as software as a service platforms for 10 years and, you know, has his mindset locked in into that kind of a way of thinking, versus the other person who comes in and says,
right,
why
right.
are you even doing this? It doesn't make any sense. Well, it's because all SaaS systems are designed like that. Well, it doesn't really make any sense. So exactly, like, you know, life is so messy. There are no, like, if you're trying to put labels on all those things, you're just limiting yourself and not.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were going to say something.
In any job. Oops, I'm sorry. I bumped the microphone. In any job that you have, okay, there are skills that you have to sort of have inherently, and then there are things you can learn on the job. Exactly. And the truth is, in a lot of positions, there's a hell of a lot you can learn on the job, okay? There are a lot of parts, tactical parts, of how the technology works and how, you know, SaaS, for example, operates and how this stuff gets built. There are a lot of nuts and bolts types of things that you can learn on the job. That is not the most critical component of you being successful at what you do. The most critical component of you being successful at what you do is the more strategic thinking part of that, right? It's the ability to go in and say, what are our challenges? What are our obstacles? How do we find out which of those really need to be solved? How do we find out what's worth doing? How do we find out what's important? How do we find out what's feasible? And how do we find out how to go forward? That's the stuff that's valuable. This insistence that, you know, you have to know every single part, every single tactical detail of a product or a service or an industry in order to be effective, it's a lie. All right. To me, it's a lie.
Okay. It sounds like.
You know, it's like the insistence that, you know, I hear this among designers and UXers and developers all the time, that if you don't know this tool or this language or this software or this process, or that you suddenly have
tools,
no value. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah, you have to know Sketch, or you have to know, you know, whatever else. You have to,
yeah. Whatever. You can learn
exactly,
Sketch in a day.
Exactly.
All right. You can learn Sketch in 24 hours. Take any program and throw it at somebody. They can learn it. All right. Any developer, just like, you know, people say, well, developers, you know, don't understand UI, don't understand UX. Absolutely untrue. Okay. I have two clients who don't have any UI design people, don't have any UX people, and are not going to hire any. Those front end developers who are largely responsible for UI and UX are doing a fantastic job at it. Why? Because they were absolutely willing to sort of open their minds and use their natural abilities in a slightly different way, right? They're thinking about different things. They're making different decisions for different reasons. You can adapt. And it's not the technical limitations of what you do that determine your value. It's how you use, I say this till I'm blue in the face, it's how you use what's between your ears.
Exactly. And, yeah, I mean, every single project in my career, pretty much, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate, was a new industry, a new process, a new technology that you just need to learn. You come in with a skill set that can make you successful in terms of you know, getting the deliverables right. But in, along the way, you just learn the technology, you learn the process, you spend time, and it's a learning curve. It has to be designed into any job, the startup time for the job, right? People just have to assume that if you are hiring a person with a product owner level or, you know, similar to that, you have to assume that if somebody comes in to this role, they have the skills to be in this position and they have the skills to learn all the missing pieces of the job. So It's really all those organizations who think differently, not like this, they pretty much shoot themselves in the foot because they contradict the assumptions that are designed into the job that they are looking for.
In a lot of cases,
because I came into until the very last gig where I consulted a cryptocurrency company and I helped them build a crypto wallet, which was very new to me. I had to learn something absolutely different. It's not a tool. It's not a traditional database. It's a fully decentralized architecture. It's nodes. There's no central server. There's a protocol. There's a main chain. There are nodes, there are wallets, and there are transactions, and there are miners. There's mining software too. And I just had to learn all this absolutely different decentralized architecture to be able to start, you know, building the wallet interfaces and stuff like that. Because if you don't understand how the underlying technology works, you cannot, you know, bring a user-friendly solution to the users. So people learn all kinds of stuff, whether it's a sketch tool or blockchain protocol. And you as a hiring manager, you have to understand that you are hiring the different skill, not, you know, learning your... nobody has to come with the knowledge of your technology or your tools. You're hiring somebody who can help you drive the project and make things happen. And this is a completely different skill set. This is just like my follow-up rant.
Well, let's see what happens. You go down a path and whatever you're passionate about inevitably comes out.
So, and, at this point in my life, I'm just, you know, following that, and I am not reacting to any other offers. Like, you know, here's the BA position. Would you like to look at it? I'm like, no, I'm just not allowed.
Nah, as you should. It's if you know where your value is, if you know what's right for you, if you know, you know, sort of what you do best, right, then you have to stick with that. You have to stick with that. And the road, you know, as long as you keep at something, the road eventually presents itself. You know, the choices, the decisions you make, the paths, even the mistakes that you make, okay, all have a way of directing you toward what it is that you're supposed to be doing. I really firmly believe that. It's been true in my own life, and it's been true in the lives of an awful lot of people that I know as well. I think you have to have faith, and you have to keep an open mind and just keep paying attention to your reactions to things and where you feel, you know, most comfortable and where you feel like people are getting the most value from you. You know, it'll come. It always comes.
Well, I mean, this basically solidifies my belief that I'm on the right track, and I'll just stay patient and, you know, do my thing. And I mean, the time that I'm using my time that I, for example, could have been on a job that I wouldn't really enjoy, I get the time to do a podcast with you, for example, right? Or spend time on Twitter engaging UX related conversations or read a pretty deep article. Mm-hmm. So I understand there is no income for me this month, right? But again, I recently started looking at all this financial side of the things as the average. You know, you kind of look back at, sometimes you look back at a year as an average. Sometimes you look back at 3 years as an average. So if you look, you know, at all the money that you made in 3 years and then divided by 36, you may still arrive at a pretty decent monthly income. But you just cannot say, you know, I have to make a certain, unless, you know, I understand there are different situations and there are certain bills that come in every single month for different people. But if you have this flexibility of, you know, making zero this month using some of the savings and making half of what you've been making next month, but then you would be making a lot more than that in the consecutive months. So it's really all about the yep. average, assuming you can, you know, afford some, you know, upsides or downsides in terms of your income.
Yeah, right.
So, Joe, we rolled over 1 hour and yeah, it was okay, but I think we'll probably be wrapping up shortly. Unless you have, you know, another topic to throw out, I'm more than happy to discuss. or maybe we wouldn't.
Yeah. No, nothing off the top of my
head. Well, one last question that I wanted to ask you, and this is something that I probably stole from Tim Ferriss, because he asks his guests like that, but it's slightly modified. So he asks people, like, you know, if you mm-hmm. had to put something on the billboard for millions of people to see, and I'll frame my question, if you had to put something on the billboard or on a sign in at a product design school or university where people, you know, go learn how to design and, you know, things like that to eventually become UXers mm-hmm. and information architects and designers and whatnot. And they would see this every single day as they come to the auditorium to listen to the lectures and stuff like that. What would that be?
Six words. Feel the fear, do it anyway. That's been the truest thing I think I've ever learned throughout my entire life. It was applicable early in my career, even though I couldn't quite do it then. It's applicable now, and it comes up in almost every conversation I have. Fear is the only thing with the potential to stop you, okay? And whatever it is, in the work that you're doing at hand right now, in your career as a whole, your advancements as a human, your personal relationships, right? From your romantic relationships to your friendships to your business dealings, it is absolutely the thing that stops people in their tracks. There are going to be plenty of times in your life and in your work when you're unsure of what you're doing, where you feel like maybe I'm not good enough mm-hmm. or smart enough or experienced enough to do this, that never stops coming up. Okay. You cannot let it stop you from acting. You have to take the step. You have to venture into the unknown. You have to get comfortable with not knowing all the answers. You have to get comfortable with the possibility that you may be making the wrong decision, but you cannot stop yourself. You can't not act as a consequence of fear. Nothing positive ever comes from that. I always say to people, if you're waiting until you feel totally confident to do something, you're going to be waiting a long time because that's never going to come. Right? So that is, I think if I could say anything to anybody, that's definitely my billboard. Because those six words have carried me further than just about anything else I can think of.
This is absolutely right. And kind of relating to Tim Ferriss, he has this framework for, you know, what's the worst that can happen, right? When you write down yeah. several things, like if you do this, what's the worst that can happen? And I actually right. had to use that right. framework when I took on my cryptocurrency gig, because I actually had to give up a full-time manager position at a pretty big healthcare company here in Minneapolis. And when I got to the manager level, it was a pretty big step up for me, because before that I was just kind of an analyst and BA type of roles. But then this opportunity came along, and I took several days to think about it. And then I actually engaged the Tim Ferriss framework. And I literally, I wrote down, okay, so even if that job that I take today, it disappears tomorrow, because I mean, that's how risky crypto space is, right? Will I be okay? Mm-hmm. And I kind of looked at my financials and my resume and talked to recruiters, and I said, I'll be okay. We may go, you know, a few months without income, but at the end, I will be okay. And so that's just one of the examples of that framework that I employed. And yeah, fear is absolutely there all the time. And emotionally, yep. like without yep. having something visual, it's really hard to define that fear, break it down, and contain it, right? But once you mm-hmm. actually verbalize certain things around this fear, you basically define it, and you look at every single outcome that can come out of the decision making. If none of those outcomes, you know, really say you'll be screwed for the rest of your life or for many years to come, then you know you can look at this and make that decision.
No, it's not going to stop you. Okay. Instead of trying to make that fear go away or make the uncertainty go away, just accept that it's going to be there and accept that you have to go forward anyway. And what you learn by doing that, and it's hard at first, all right? It's really hard. I don't want to minimize that. It's difficult.
It is hard.
And sometimes it's emotionally difficult as well. It's painful. But what you learn is that even when you make mistakes, and ones that feel at the time like colossal, monumental mistakes, they don't sink your ship, okay? They really don't stop you. You get to go on and live another day and have another chance to do it right. And you learn from that, right? That's how you build confidence. It's how you build courage. It's how you build a willingness to keep going forward. And that willingness is required if you're going to be good at what you do.
Well, I think this is an absolutely awesome way to wrap up the episode. This conversation exceeded all my expectations, Joe. I knew it was going to be a blast,
you.
But you know, in terms of
thank you
validating my assumptions and fears, you know, for that matter, that I could be on the wrong track or something like that, and hopefully it brings tremendous value to the listeners, because I mean, you'll probably share it with your followers, and they will probably learn a ton
absolutely
from this conversation. So,
yeah, I hope so.
So, Joe, thank you so much. Again, super blessed. I just cannot stop talking about that. And thank you guys for tuning in. Hopefully you really enjoyed this conversation. It was very insightful for me, and hopefully it was equally insightful for you guys. Stay tuned. I'll be coming up with more episodes soon, and thank you.